Welcome to Marxism Today. I am Red Wagner, and I'm joined by
Tony Schmidt
and
Thad Logan.
And we're back. I know we've been gone for a while, but we're back.
Yeah, it's okay. We don't have a Patreon with monthly subscribers, so we're not like robbing anyone.
That's right.
Donated money.
We're not held to your monthly contributions, or we used to do, I guess, every other week.
Good to start the podcast off with just cold aggression hacking towards the audience.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, jerks.
Hey, bitches. Okay.
Well, it has been a bit. It was good to be back.
Yeah.
Back in the studio. Basement.
I'm trying to decide if I should apologize to listeners or we're just probably just going to cut that part out.
Oh, for yelling at them?
Yeah.
Well, you didn't do that. I did. But I'm not apologizing.
And we made a joke out of it. They understand. Right, listeners? If you don't, go to the subreddit. Let us know that you don't that you're mad. Also, you should keep plugging that subreddit. Do you plug it every time?
No.
No.
I also don't read it.
It's in the credits.
That's my problem.
I check it sometimes.
Do you?
Yeah.
Because that's just awesome.
It's in the end credits that I'm sure nobody listens to. Anyway. So today, we're going to talk about kind of current events. Current-ish. About, I guess, how things have been since we haven't been on, which is largely since Trump started.
Uh-huh.
In case you missed it, Donald Trump is our president. I still find that really bizarre to say.
I think we had one episode since the Trump election.
Did we? Okay.
Maybe.
But yeah, a lot has happened. He's been president for a little over 100 days now.
Uh-huh.
And the world is a scarier place for it. At this very second, the French people are going to the polls, and Marie Le Pen, the fascist of the National Front, might win, although she looks unfavorable, but...
So did Trump.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, and so did Brexit. It's like the exact same story over and over again.
Why? Because it's I like that. It's centrist banker versus a fascist. There's bank-friendly centrist versus a fascist.
Yeah.
That doesn't sound familiar at all.
In the case of France, he literally is a banker, right?
Literally is a banker and literally is a fascist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, whereas in the U.S. we just had someone with close ties to fascists and someone with close ties to bankers.
Hey, Le Pen kicked her father out of the party. They're totally different.
She's a moderate. You know what? I take it back. She's a moderate fascist.
Hey, she turned around in a couple years. This is pretty amazing. Never seen that before.
Yeah. She's like, Dad, we're not supposed to say we're Nazis anymore. We get in trouble for that. And he's like, but we are. And she's like, shh, goodbye.
She put a pillow over his face. That's what it sounded like.
Yeah, that's what I'm imagining in my head.
Politically, yes.
Yeah, right?
Okay. Trump first 100 days. I was going to ask best and worst, but maybe we should just ask worst.
There's one thing he's done that I actually am okay with. Exactly one.
What is it?
He pulled out of the TPP.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Yep.
That is the one and only thing he's done, though. And he did it for the wrong reasons as well.
I
think if he understood it, he probably wouldn't have, since it's meant to undercut China's growing strength economically in Asia. So I think if he actually understood things and wasn't just like a dumb baby angry man, that he wouldn't have pulled out of it.
China's a great thing to bring up too. I mean, he's already flipped his position on China. I mean, mm-hmm. Talking about positions with Trump is weird though, because a lot of what you hear about is just like stupid tweets, and you're like, well, who cares if that's? I mean, is that a position? I don't know, especially because they have very little consistency. But he has called China a currency manipulator for many, many years, and worse things than that. But very recently, has started to change that around and talk more glowingly about how we should work with China and things like that, which isn't the worst idea in the whole world. Depends on how we work with them, though, but it's certainly not consistent.
Well, I mean, he does come off, and maybe this is exactly what he is, I don't know for sure, but he at least comes off as, like, a guy who doesn't know very much but watches a lot of TV and has a very strong feeling that he's getting ripped off.
I think that you got him pegged exactly.
We got to go around. Yeah, let's go around and talk about the, like, the big things that hit us in the last 100 days. Like, maybe not the best or worst, but just takeaways. Because okay. I have a few in particular, and I don't know where they classify, but what do you, who wants to start?
You know what? Since Tony did start with the TPP, one thing I wanted to mention, just because, like, the listeners, I'm sure many know a lot about the TPP, but just in case you don't, the kind of left-wing stance on it was, first of all, it was a trade deal, Trans-Pacific Partnership, right? And it... So it was a trade deal with the U.S. and a bunch of countries and a bunch of countries in Asia, including China, right? Were they part of it?
I think China might have been excluded from it.
They were not in it. Okay, so we were trying to, like, make stronger ties with whatever. But the big critique of it from the left was it allowed corporations to attack local laws, national laws, state laws, local laws, if they felt like it was a trade impediment.
Yeah.
So if you wanted to make sure that your lake that you live by was clean and you had certain laws to protect it, a company could come in and say, look, this is a trade barrier because we want to do X, Y, and Z, which will cause pollution, but it makes our product that we then trade on a global market or whatever.
Yeah. And they actually, there was a provision where they could sue countries for perceived loss of profits based on that. So not only could you go in and do that, but you could also sue them for the $1 trillion you thought that you were deserved.
So Trump pulled out of that.
Yeah. But probably not because he was super concerned about corporations suing individuals or nations.
No, he did it out of the nationalistic American jobs, which it would have made it easier to offshore a job. So he is right in that fashion, except he's wrong in that he thinks that American industrial strength can come back, which it basically can't.
Relying on the fossil fuel industry for that is it's going to be such a horrible reckoning for people thinking because that industry didn't die out purely politically. It died out economically. Mm-hmm. Like it was not feasible for the businesses. And already alternative energy is booming. Like it's a big industry with growing number of jobs. So you could have had the same message Trump had getting elected, but you don't have to focus on fossil fuel. You can say we're going to rely on the burgeoning alternative energy economy to be competitive in the world and also increase jobs here. But you focus on fossil fuels because that's what the Rust Belt workers respond to. That's what they used to have. That's what their cities lived by. And so that hits that bell. You know, that's that whistle in their head that turns their ear towards Trump and is like, oh yeah, yeah, I want things back how they were. Yeah, you didn't need to. And still focusing on that's going to be a hard slog for them to even try to put, they're going to be dumping money into making jobs in a dying industry when we could be. So it's not going to help the industry. It's not going to help the people getting employed, like, or who would be employed.
Yeah. And I mean, he's not even like trying to do that stuff. The only place he's actually courting new job growth is Silicon Valley. Like, Apple is all on board with him, as is Facebook, which shouldn't be surprising to anybody that Zuckerberg is basically a wannabe fascist as well.
He's doing some stuff. So, like, the pipeline and things like that.
Oh, okay. That's right. Yeah. I'm thinking specifically of coal, but yeah, you're 100% right about the pipelines.
So, I mean, but that's the thing about Trump, too, is like, yeah, especially in his 100 days, how much has he done, you know, specifically? And what is this going to be the pace of the rest of his presidency?
And what's one of your big takeaways, Thad?
Oh, okay. So I think one of the biggest things that's come out of Trump is not even necessarily related to Trump, but it's related. Well, it is. It's bigger than him. It's how he won. It's how people are perceiving things. And I think it comes from the real polarization that's taking place in the country. And it is just how we interpret facts, how we look at facts. And in some ways, it's really good. People, I think, are now much more aware of sources of information than they used to be, and hopefully more critical. If you come away from this election with any downside, if you came away from that election feeling bad, I think a big part of it was, oh, I didn't realize what was going to happen. There was a lot of things not told to me, and maybe I was in a little bit of a Facebook bubble, an echo chamber there. So it's made me more critical. But on a downside, I feel like people value opinions pretty equally. I think there are some exceptions to that, but we try to say that opinions should be on the same level. Everyone's entitled to a certain opinion, but we're starting to say that opinions and facts are kind of on the same level, that you can dispute a fact with some opinions, and you can call them fake news and things like that. And the fact that Trump can consistently just lie about stuff and not be held accountable to it, I think is a huge part of that, because he can come out and say Obama is wiretapping him, and then he can be on the news months later and be questioned about it. And he literally did this. He just said he won't talk. And he was in the Oval Office, and he turned away and sat down behind his desk and said, I'm done. Because the guy just said, well, what's your opinion on it? He said, who wants to hear from me? And he's like, well, you're the president. What's your opinion on it? And so he just, there's very little accountability in this weird way. And it's working. I wonder where the rubber's going to meet the road. That's the big thing. So you have the Emoluments Clause. You have a lot of things that seem real dicey about the Trump administration. The Russian investigation is ongoing. But a lot of these things, it's like, oh, where's the accountability? If no one cares about you lying, if no one's going to do anything about it, where's the accountability? If you have a House and Senate controlled by your party, will you get... Should you fear impeachment? I don't know. It's opened up this really... In the past, I felt a lot more secure in the sense that if you lied and there was direct proof, you'd probably get punished for it. But it's not that way anymore.
Yeah, and I think one place that it's not coming from, that he's not being held accountable from, is the Democrats. Because they either are 100% happy to work with him on stuff, which is ludicrous, or they live in a weird delusional world still where they're just blaming... I mean, I think Hillary Clinton just came out the other day in an interview saying, oh, and I know we talked about this a different time when we were recording, it was Russia and the FBI that screwed me over, and that's why I didn't win. And so I think the Democrats are still... And I mean, yeah, the FBI, I think, certainly influenced it. You talked about degrees of that. I don't know if that was enough to nudge him over in the electoral bits, because I think probably in the states that he won, I don't know how much that specific thing played a role. I think he probably would have won the states he was going to win either way, but it certainly didn't help her image.
Did you hear recently that Comey said he was nauseated by having to do that?
Yeah.
Because he felt like it would have been worse not to say that, you know, they were like reopening the investigation or something. But yeah, in his recent... I don't know, deposition or whatever that
yeah.
was.
Yeah. But, I mean, the Democrats are basically just trying to focus on this weird Russia thing, saying he was colluding with Russia. And, I mean, the weird thing about that to me is, yeah, he was talking, his people were talking to Russian officials, but every presidential administration talks to other officials before they're actually elected. Like, this isn't that, and this isn't even the worst thing. I mean, Iran-Contra with Hillary's good chum Henry Kissinger is probably the worst example of that, where he made secret deals with a hostile foreign power and just did awful consequences and awful things because of that. And, you know, nobody talked impeachment, or I guess I wasn't alive then. So I don't know. I don't remember hearing about people talking about impeaching Reagan. In fact, I believe everybody loved Reagan for that. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this isn't a new thing. It isn't actually even that bad. The only thing I can actually find about it that's problematic for Trump and Trump administration is that Flynn lied about it.
Sure.
Like, that's really the only actual problem
right.
there.
And more recently, Kushner, it's revealed that he didn't divulge a bunch of, not just Russian-related stuff, right? But he just didn't divulge a bunch, like that he has $1 billion in debt. So it's just this weird, shady stuff that comes out. But also it could be that an administration run poorly has a lot of cracks in it and people forget to say things. And there's a lot of evidence that his administration's run really poorly. Like in the first 100 days, the amount of leaks coming out about everything, like, you could just see. And also the reports of a lot of infighting going on between the real like right wing side of things and the real business and bank side of the administration, like the Bannon side versus the Trump Kushner type stuff. Like, but then you just hear, you know, like the executive order that put Bannon on the Security Council, and Trump's like, I didn't know it'd do that. And you're like, that's so bad in so many ways. Because you didn't read it, but someone still wrote it. And you still signed it. And it's like, oh, that's not evil. It's dumb. It's something else. It's still really scary. But yeah, this, so, I don't know, that's another takeaway. Just like the initial reports where he wakes up and he watches like Fox News or Morning Joe. Like they have the shows he watches, and then you can see his tweets and you can connect them specifically to that day's segment on that show. And I think he's backed off a bit on that because it was so obvious. But yeah, you know, it's certainly shaking things up. It's very different than it used to be.
I mean, just quickly on the ineptitude of the administration, I don't know if this has changed yet. I haven't heard that it has. But are you guys aware that we have... So they told all of the federal prosecutors to quit. And then one guy didn't, and they fired him. You don't know if you guys heard that a while ago. Yeah, I guess that's not uncommon when a new administration comes in. So here's the thing. We have zero federal prosecutors right now. In, like, the month since they got rid of everybody, and again, this is a little bit older news, so it might have changed a bit. They haven't hired a single federal prosecutor. Not one.
Because it's part of the hiring ban or whatever? The hiring freeze?
No, they just haven't done it.
There's a long list of that, though, like heads of departments and stuff that just don't exist. Yeah, that they just haven't...
They just haven't, like, put anyone forward for almost anything. It's bizarre.
What do you guys think about media and this idea? Like, just as far as how to find who gives you information that you feel they have some authenticity, that they have some integrity. Like, I think in general, the mainstream media actually is still pretty good. Not like I'm talking about newspapers, I think. Not necessarily the 24-hour news networks, because I don't look at them, but I do see articles. From the big ones, and when they're wrong, they do have retractions and corrections, but there's still like good journalism happening out there, but there's just so much other stuff that's filtering it and adding opinion to it. I don't know, what are your guys' take on that right now? For yourselves, have you changed at all? Have you altered the way you get information politically?
Well, I only have two that I regularly follow. I mean, when people do link stuff, I'll go and look at it. So, you know, I see a lot of stuff from like New York Times and whatnot, and that seems to be okay-ish, depending on who's writing it.
Right.
But the two big ones that I go to are, I listen to Democracy Now! Every morning, at least the headline bits, just to get a handle onto what is going on. And then The Intercept their website is just always has phenomenal journalism, but they've also started doing a weekly podcast sort of talking about the Trump administration stuff called Intercepted, and that is phenomenal. So I've been listening to that a lot because they do, you know, good, deep, hard-hitting investigative journalism. Mm-hmm. So those are the two I regularly go to. And that's about all I regularly go to.
I think the general question of, like, I think there's a couple things going on when it comes to media. There's the question of bubbles. Do you live in a bubble? And there's the question of is the news or the thing that you're reading accurate? And I think when it comes to the accuracy, you know, obviously I'm coming from the left on this, but it's like I think the main problem there, the thing that sticks out to me as particularly bad are like the real like kind of conspiracy theory, right-wing nut job stuff where like the whole idea that Hillary Clinton was running a child sex scandal out of a pizza place, like, that's just nuts. And, like, to me, that's, like, the real attack on not just truth, but reality, I guess.
Well, it literally caused a guy to go there with a gun. I mean,
yeah,
it caused terrorism.
So, you know, but the idea that there's Breitbart News, and there's Fox News, and there's MSNBC, and there's Democracy Now. I would guess in most cases that is relatively honest journalism. Even the right wing bullshit that I totally disagree with. I think let me see how I want to say this. What bugs me is when fake news is used to mean way more than it should mean. Mm-hmm. Fake news is not satire. Fake news is not someone's opinion that you disagree with. Fake news is not someone leaving out a piece of information or choosing this story over that story. Those are regular bias things, and they're important things to be aware of. But bias is not the same as fake news. And, mm-hmm. and you know, maybe, you know, language is determined by how we actually use it. So maybe we'll end up losing this battle, right? But in my mind, the appropriate use for the word fake news is something that is knowingly untrue and is designed to deceive or to further a misconception that the audience has.
The problem is there's so much gray area and nuance. I mean, you can have specific facts, and if you lie about those, it's kind of easy to verify that, although sometimes that doesn't go very far anyway. But is so, for instance, when Trump tweeted that, you know, the first and second healthcare bill died very easily in the courts because they're unconstitutional. The healthcare one and the immigration ban. But he said a lot of the reason that he's been struggling, one of his tweets said that it's the liberals and Democrats' fault for stonewalling them. but here's the issue. Yeah. There are going to be plenty of people who, because he makes a statement like that and you have a president participating in this, and fine, all presidents have participated in spin. I am totally sure of that, and most politicians as well. But because we kind of get to this point where it's like, how do you ever verify that? And you could, I guess, make some sort of statement that well, the Republican Party is really divided, and if we had some support from the Democrats, we'd be able to work together, and we should be working together across the aisle because we're all in this country together, and we should find common ground to cooperate. But there's a lot of hypocrisy in that, considering how the Republicans handled things in the past with Obama, and considering that they control the freaking House.
Yeah.
And they control the Congress. So
your argument can't be that we had no Democratic votes when you didn't need any.
Yeah. But it is the argument, and someone can see that. And okay, everyone has their biases, and obviously when you see something that confirms your bias, you're just going to support it. But and I think I was doing that with my Facebook bubble prior to the election. But that's the issue, is that there's so – when you have Fox News, yeah, they might not be outright lying on everything, but the stories they choose to run, how they choose to frame them, the kind of really abstract, very complex issues described very simply, those are the things that just rub me the wrong way. And I'm sure the more left mainstream media sources do it as well. But I don't know, because I just don't watch them, because it's always right. So much of this, and the theater of the fights. You know, CNN puts two people on from left and right to fight with each other, and they're just yelling, and you don't learn anything. But they're both on the payroll. CNN just pays, you know, right wing pundits to come. So it's just like, what? Nah.
Yeah.
I can't. I don't know.
And neither one of them's trying to get at the truth. They're just trying to look better than the other one.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have this problem when I argue with people too. Is that is the way that discourse tends to go with a lot of people now? Like, people just aren't interested in actually discussing things. They're just interested in arguing about it. There's no move to resolution, or like. You can literally just lay out the facts, show them the information, and just go, no, that's not right. Okay. I do worry that it seriously does impact discourse, like on a daily level.
And Trump is an effect of that, but he's also a cause of it. Yeah, I mean, like, I think it's built now into a bigger level.
You know, one thing about the breaking of bubbles and things like that, something that I've noticed about myself since the election is I feel like I have at least an awareness of a whole bunch of right-wing media that I was not aware of before. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure it's a good thing. Like, I know the name Milo Yiannakopoulos.
Yeah.
Should I know that name?
Yeah, you want to keep him away from your kids.
Like, I just don't know, man. And like, and Richard Spencer, and then Breitbart News. It's like, all these things that probably aren't that big of a deal.
Yeah.
But I feel like have been made into a bit, quote unquote, big deal because people are like, I don't know, afraid of them, or they're like extremely right wing or whatever. Like, they're sensational. But yeah. like for me to be concerned about what Milo Yiannakopoulos is saying, is it sort of like when, like, the local news is, you won't believe what teenagers are doing. It's called such and such, but it's not what you think it is. And it's like, turns out no one's really doing it, but someone joked about it or whatever. You know, yeah. Like...
Wait, you guys don't butt chug?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Man. That's, like, so old.
That's exactly what that was, though. Like, one instance of it, and then, oh, it's a phenomenon. Fear for the lives of your children.
Yeah, the same thing with... Pepe the Frog being a fascist symbol or a neo-Nazi symbol, it's like it's just something on the internet. And if it's on the internet, people will do basically everything with it. So the fact that there are neo-Nazi versions of Pepe the Frog, that's not really surprising because there's an everything version of Pepe the Frog.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And to send out a memo or whatever to, like, be talking about the real threat of a picture of a cartoon frog is silly and ridiculous. Like, it gives... What it does is it grants the thing the power that you thought it had, but it never really had. You know? Like, to treat it like a real threat is to give it the popularity for it to have the weight that you were assigning it, but fallaciously or whatever.
Right. Yeah, you're agreeing with them. I mean, essentially, you're throwing yourself in the same bucket with the small amount of actual neo-Nazis that wanted to use it that way. You're like, okay, yeah, I'll follow your lead. Yeah, that's what it means.
You're
now
handing them the power.
Yep.
It's basically, I will say...
Like, I guess to summarize my point, it's sort of like... we didn't have any neo-Nazis at the debate table, and now we do have them. It's like, really, should they be there? Like, maybe there weren't that many of them, and it was okay not to have them. Like, do we also need to have, like, the guy wearing a tinfoil hat at the debate table just because there's some people out there wearing a tinfoil hat? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I literally heard NPR, I think this was in the lead-up to the election, they had, yeah, a neo-Nazi on. Or I think it was just, I think they just called them like a white supremacist or maybe even generously alt-righter. But yeah, they literally just had them on to espouse their views as if they were just like some fucking misunderstood group that, you know, gosh darn it, if you just listen, you'll find out they're real people and not hateful monsters.
I'm conflicted about this.
Yeah.
Because on one hand, yes, giving them any voice at all gives the implication that they deserve to have a platform to talk about it. But completely silencing them or not having them be part of it, the downside of that, and I'm not even talking about like free speech, I think there's always going to be a line. Like, we can't have people coming in and being like, you should put poop in your tea. And you're like, well, let's talk about why you should do that. Maybe you shouldn't. Well, you choose for yourself, audience. But there's probably a line there where you don't cross it. But when you do have a lot of people in the country that might agree with the person, having someone who calmly and in a collected manner disagrees with them, points out like facts and information that – because I think the downside is that – and the downside to not knowing about those right-wing sources is that you lose track of the people who aren't you. And those people are still in the country. And when you're talking about discussing with them, like what Tony said, bridging that gap to not argue but to try to find common ground – kind of have to understand where they're coming from a little bit. And you have to be okay sometimes talking to a racist and telling them why it's wrong. Because if you actually...
And if you never do, then you're not very good at arguing with racists.
Like, yeah. And if you disagree with that racist, you probably think that your environment and where your upbringing can have a lot of influence on who you end up becoming. So maybe you agree that in the right circumstances, you could have been a racist. And maybe that could help you bridge that gap right there. Like, if that's a moment where you can maybe think that you, by the grace of God, go, I could be this guy. Let me figure out how I could have been that guy. And maybe I could figure out how I could describe to myself how to get out of that. I think those are the only upsides to knowing those things. Because I do think they give you a lot of pollution. I do think they have the ability, if you give people those platforms, to lend credence to them, to their movement, in a way that you would not want. Mm-hmm. But I'm conflicted, but I think the downside is less than the potential upsides. I think. I don't know.
Yeah, because you don't want to exclude it thinking this is less than 1% of the population. It's so small that it doesn't matter. To give them a platform is to make them seem like a bigger deal and to actually give them promotion. But at the same time, well, what if it's 10% of the population? Then then at some point you got to engage with it.
Yep.
And I guess that's one of the more difficult things. It's like, okay, so like, where does
where's that line?
Richard Spencer or Breitbart News fall on that line?
And how do you engage with it? Because I think part of the reason, my guess is when they had that white supremacist on, they maybe devolved into arguing, like I see on CNN a lot, or they just didn't get to anything substantial. And it's like, well, if you're going to have them, you give them conflict, address some of the things they say, be ready with facts, knowing what they'll pull out to contradict them and say, well, how do you support this when the evidence isn't there? Or actually do a bunch of research and show these people up. Because a lot of times if you just handle it, give them a voice, let them say their bit, we'll say our bit and we'll move on. So, well, no, I don't. I think that's the wrong way to handle it, because that does equalize things in a way that I think is troubling.
Right. In NPR, I think for that specific case, I don't even think they had a counterpoint person. They were just like, oh, so how's it being a white supremacist? Tell me about it. No, what are you doing today? Something ridiculous like that. Or, I know other right wing people are all about the free speech for people protesting people like Milo or Richard Spence or Milo, whatever his name is. But the problem with that is that it's just them speaking. It's not actually a discussion most of the time for things. And that's where I think, that's the most dangerous. And I'm just going to say right now, it's not violating someone's free speech to protest against them and they cancel an event.
Is that the Ann Coulter thing or the Milo thing? I think I've heard it for both of them.
I think I've heard it for many of them.
Yeah.
That's not a violation of someone's free speech. They're allowed to go talk, but if the venue chooses to cancel it because there are people who are unhappy with it and they decide that it's not worth it, that's not violating someone's free speech.
Yep.
If you physically prevent them from speaking, if you were to tackle them and sew their lips shut, amusing though that would be, that's not that's violating someone's free speech. If you make it illegal for them to speak, that's problematic.
The thing I'm about to say is a little bit reductive, but I want to say it because it's something else I've noticed since Trump has been elected. Because I think on both sides, left and right on the spectrum, there are radicals and there are people who don't think objectively or rationally, and they also don't have healthy discourse with one another. And so it's not specific to either side. I think both of them do it, but the right in the conservative wing, or just the right in general, in America in the last 10 years have made a big point of talking about PC culture, and it being an issue, and, the war on Christmas and things like that. But since Trump has been elected, I've seen a lot of cases where people just get really mad that someone said, Colbert is the most recent example. Mm. He made a joke about, and I don't have to repeat it here because I don't want to suddenly make this an R-rated podcast, but a sexually related joke. And their thing is like, well, it's a homophobic joke and it's bad. And I kind of get that. I think they're trying to use some of the liberals' own logic against them. But I've also seen a lot of these cases where, like this, it's not against your free speech to have a venue turn you down. But a lot of them are saying that and mad that it happened. And it's like, well, isn't it that business's choice or that college's choice? And a lot of them sort of being hypocritical on that line. Whereas when that happens, the response I would imagine them, be mad that it happened, but not think it's a free speech issue.
Yeah. The thing I will say about the Colbert thing that disturbs me is that they are looking, they're trying to get the FCC to fine him or something for that.
Mm.
Which, that
it was bleeped though, right?
Yeah, it doesn't matter. But that worries me because
the swear words were bleeped, yeah.
That I think sets a dangerous precedent on free speech, because I'm sure that comes from the administration going, you need to clamp down on this.
Sure.
Whether directly or indirectly, but I mean that there, trying to punish people for using their free speech in that sort of way. I mean, it's sort of like trying to send a message to other media people that you can't talk about the president badly.
Right.
I mean,
and that's a scary thing. I mean, that's not necessarily a violation of free speech, but that could be a step down the slippery slope.
Because there are FCC fines if you don't bleep a swear word or whatever.
And I guess it weren't swear words, but they bleep the word for penis, whatever he ended up. He might have used the cock for it or something, and that's why they bleeped it. With the bleeps, you kind of don't know what he's saying too. So it works. If you're a little kid, you don't obviously as an adult, you have the context clues to understand what he's saying, and it was great. It was a very good rant he went on at the end of that monologue.
Okay, I want to bring in a different topic instead of media.
Cool.
Let's talk about healthcare. So they had the first attempt at repeal or replace or repeal and replace or whatever. They did the first attempt and it failed. That is, the Republicans attempted it. And it was really interesting for me to watch because in many ways it epitomized a interesting question about the Trump presidency, which is Trump a right-wing free market ideologue, pro-rich people, screw the poor people, or is he a, like, right-wing racist populist who's going to help out all of the, like, poor people who, basically the white middle class rural folks who voted him into power? Is he because that's what you normally do, right? Like, our governor here in Wisconsin, when he got elected, he attacked any groups that did not vote for him. Teachers didn't vote for him. They were viciously attacked. And all sorts of public sector unions voted against him, but not police and firemen, and they were excluded from the attack on public sector unions. So it was very clear that he's rewarding the people who voted for him, punishing the people who didn't vote for him. And that's not an unusual thing to do. Like, that's kind of just how it works in general, even if it's not, like, a fully corrupt thing. Like, you're probably running on a platform that supports someone, and that's why they vote for you, and then you enact the thing that you said you were going to do for them.
Also, with conservatives, while unions are not thought of kindly, a lot of them like police and fire. Like, those are upheld in the same way military is. So,
yep.
Ideologically, I can see why he might have made that decision, too.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it fits right in, right?
Yeah,
I guess my point here is, the stuff that Scott Walker, governor of Wisconsin, has done is like playbook-style Republican stuff. And the big question with Trump was, what's he going to do? Because on the campaign trail, he kind of did both a little bit.
Right.
And he contradicts himself so often that it's really hard to tell, what exactly he meant, if anything. You know, he just kind of says whatever.
He's keeping you on your toes.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
The Affordable Care Act was bad, but he's going to do good things for healthcare for people, is what he said, basically.
Yeah, like, one of the interviews that he did on the campaign trail was, we got to cover everyone.
Yep.
We got to cover everyone, and it's going to cost less. And if you know anything about healthcare, you know that there is a way to do that. There is a way that covers everyone and costs less, and lots of other countries have figured it out. It's single payer or some, quasi-single-payer system. Lots of, not every first-world country with good, cheap healthcare has full-on single-payer, but they either have it or they have something much closer to it than what we have in the United States.
Yeah. I will jump in quick and say that there is a House bill. It's 676, I think, that's got about 100 co-sponsors. That is a really good single-payer system that, I don't think it's ever going to actually get voted upon, but boy, oh boy, would that one be phenomenal.
Yeah. So, Trump promises this, and actually, it's sort of like, oh, might he do it? Like, he probably won't be single payer, but will he move more in that direction and just kind of sell it as a Trump thing? Sometimes you, as a member of one party, are more free to do the thing that the other party normally stands for. Because you don't have the same opposition from your party because you're part of that party.
Right.
It was probably easier for Bill Clinton to cut taxes on the rich because he was a Democrat.
Right.
To do welfare reform.
The Affordable Care Act was a Republican plan. That was what Mitt Romney came up with.
Yeah, although it's definitely more in the, Democrats' wheelhouse of, the things that it's doing are more on the side of the Democrats than the Republicans. But you got a good point that, there are moderate Republicans that were kind of on board with that same thing, like Mitt Romney.
Yeah.
So that was, the kind of the question, right? Is he going to be, an Ayn Rand-style Paul Ryan, total free market? If you can afford healthcare, then you can afford it. If you can't afford it, too bad. That's one approach. Or was he going to be a populist? Because that was what I'd even say more of his rhetoric was about populism. So that first healthcare bill, what he was doing was trying to walk the line, I think. He's trying to do both. He's trying to do some things that the right-wing Republicans, the Freedom Caucus, would like. Especially at the very end, they threw in a couple of particularly right-wing things. But he didn't want to, you know, have a bunch of people who voted for him all of a sudden get sick and die because they don't have health care anymore. So it was kind of this, you know, it was this thing where if you were a moderate Republican, it was too right-wing for you to vote for. It was too draconian. And if you were a right-wing Republican, it was too moderate.
Too much of the same, too.
Yeah, it was Obamacare light or whatever.
Yep.
And, you know, that was kind of interesting because what he tried to do was walk the middle, find a compromise between those two strains. And it turned out that those two strains are, at least it seemed at the time, mutually exclusive. Like, you can't... The things to do to get these people, the right-wing Republicans, to vote on it are the exact same things that you need to not do to get the moderate Republicans to vote on it. So it turned out it wasn't like the middle was more votes. The middle was actually less, I think, than if you went one way or the other on it. I don't know, but it failed, right? Okay. Now he has gone the full right-wing way.
Oh, real quick, just say that first attempt might have been a conscious effort to try to please everybody. It also might have been just like a really disorganized administration pushing something out because they said they would. Because it was also really it was poorly done in a lot of ways too, and it was pretty short. And they actually pointed out that it being small was a good a plus. And I could see that something overly complex isn't good if it's complex to be complex.
I feel like Trump has a conversation, it not being long is a good thing often.
Yeah. But to say like, oh, this has very few ideas or points, I don't know. So it also, there was some evidence that suggested to me that maybe it wasn't quite that thoughtful, but maybe not.
I agree that disorganization played a role in it, but I'm going to tie in a couple other strains that follow this same pattern to support my argument.
Yeah, go for it.
So, with the current bill that's proposed, that's at least where we are right now at the recording of this. Who knows if it'll bomb or pass. Hopefully it'll bomb. But that's full-blown right-wing free market ideologue. When Trump got into office, a bunch of his appointees were from both of those sides, right? He had the Steve Bannon, who was the right-wing racist populist kind of guy. And he also had a bunch of guys from Goldman Sachs, you know, which would be like the free market, pro-rich, blah, blah, blah. Well, Steve Bannon is pretty much out of there, but the Goldman Sachs guys are still there. Another one, what was it? There was another thing that was kind of along those same lines.
Of the anti-populist? The bank Trump?
Yeah. Oh! The other thing that fits into this argument is taxes. When he was campaigning, in one of the Republican debates, he said, if you make less than $50,000 a year, you're not going to pay any taxes.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that was a very populist thing to say, honestly, because that, I mean, that's like a lot of the country.
Yep.
It's like, whatever,
yeah.
The bottom 40, 50%, something like that, I don't know.
60%.
Maybe.
I would guess.
I don't know. And it depends on if you mean individuals or family or whatever. But, like, yeah, somewhere around half of the population is not going to pay any taxes, is what he's saying. And it's the bottom half, right? And even kind of made some comments that, you know, seem kind of hopeful on the tax front. Well, he released a sad excuse for a tax plan, a one-page piece of paper that really doesn't have very many details, right? It says he's going to double the standard deduction. At least he wants to. This is just a pie in the sky at this point, so who knows what will actually happen. But it says double the standard deduction, which is like nowhere near $50,000, right? So a standard deduction for a single person is around $6,000. For a couple, it's around $12,000, right? So if he doubles it, okay, could get up to 24,000 for a couple, but that's still nowhere near what he was talking about before. Mm-hmm. He's getting rid of the 15% tax bracket, which means it'll go from 10 straight up to 25, I guess. Tons of people are in that 15% tax bracket. That's kind of like the middle class bracket. Like, middle and lower middle bracket probably are in that. I don't know.
When you say getting rid of that bracket, what replaces it?
See, that's what nobody knows.
Oh.
Because it's a one-page plan. So it says, okay, we're not going to have that bracket. But then, okay, so when does it switch to 25? Does 25 move into where 15 was? Or does 25 pick up where it left off? Like, there's no details about that. Yeah. So, like...
And if you think your tax plan is good, like you're saying it is, why don't you have those details worked out yet?
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. He gave out this piece of paper, and unless you make, as a couple, less than $24,000 a year, then you kind of know where you lie on it, right? Mm-hmm. Or as a single person, less than $12,000 a year, then you kind of know where you fall on it. But if you make more than that, you know, if you're kind of middle class, you have no idea. Are your taxes going to go up or down? Nobody knows. He's going to get rid of a bunch of deductions at the same time, so it also depends on what your deductions are. But, he doesn't tell you the most important information that 99% of the people need to know to figure out what their taxes are going to be, or 90% or 80% or whatever.
Wasn't he getting rid of, the housing deduction that most middle-class people use?
Mortgage interest deduction is staying, I think.
Okay, that is staying.
But still, whatever, he throws out this tax plan where you can't tell a middle-class family based on what's been presented if they will owe more or less in taxes. You just don't know because there's not enough information. But most of that one-page piece of paper was about taxes that he wanted to get rid of. And almost all of them are taxes that are on the rich. Like, the first third of a piece of paper was, we're going to do all this stuff. Nobody really knows if they're going to pay more or less. Except for rich people. And that's two-thirds of the rest of the tax plan on that one-page piece of paper is, we're going to get rid of the inheritance tax. And we're going to get rid of the alternative minimum tax. And, all these taxes that are basically made to make sure that rich people are not... screwing the system even more than they probably already are, there's lots of ways the rich people have to get out of paying taxes, but there are some rules that are still okay, you gotta at least pay this much. He wants to get rid of those. That's what most of his tax plan is gimme, 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 gimme. Give the rich, including me, because I'm rich, a huge, huge tax cut. And so the populism, maybe he's making a token effort or whatever. It's basically not there. Same thing with healthcare. The populism is not there. He's gone full bore right-wing capitalist mode.
Yeah, and don't forget about the corporate tax.
Yeah.
He wants to drop that from 35, which is laughably low already, to 15%. Which I think the government, whatever the government budget office, I think, said would cost something like $2 trillion out of the economy that would raise the debt.
Will this hurt Trump? Will this hurt the Republican Party? That makes me wonder. I mean,
it certainly won't hurt their campaign donations.
Yeah, this is one of the problems that I think, and I'm not sure about this, but I think that Trump's base, the folks that ended up voting for Trump, not everyone, of course, but I think a lot of the Trump voters, they're basically low-information voters that watch a lot of TV who, in my experience, they often really like conspiracy theories.
Yeah.
And I just don't think many of them pay that close of attention. They're not – Trump is not a policy wonk, and I don't think his followers are either. You know, when the people that voted for Trump are not doing any better 3 or 4 years down the line or whatever – I'm not sure they're really going to know why.
That's the dangers of a cult of personality. It can be very powerful in leading people, but it's also kind of substanceless. When it's all about a personality, the actions that take place aren't as important as how they're presented.
Yeah.
And what you and in a world like this, where you can really heavily filter what you get presented to begin with, yeah, you can kind of just go with anything. And I think those people, that base you're talking about, they're current conditions do matter, whether they're in poverty, whether there's a lot of drug addiction going on in their local government and things like that. But still, how they decide to react towards that is not always clear. Like, it's not always coherent with the ideology that they're voting for. I mean, because I think people who voted for Obama voted for Trump as well. Mm-hmm. And so it's less about that. It's more about things are bad. This guy sounds good. And a lot of what was appealing about him was that he just wasn't a politician. Like, mm-hmm. It was really hard for me to divorce him from the things he says. But if you do that, he's kind of entertaining to listen to. I think that's also why he really likes to get back out there and give speeches, like go on the trail, like campaign after he's won, which he's done a couple times now. And because that's where he's strongest. He has charisma. He can go on and on for a long time. And that's the downside. That's what I worry about. Like, because there's no accountability. Because that's all you were voting for, kind of. You were voting for him, and he's always going to be like that. What, you weren't necessarily voting on a platform. So what happens now? I don't know. But like you talking about the DSA and the amount of people who've been mobilized to join groups, political groups on the left that they weren't motivated to do or to join during Obama's administration, I think that is a silver lining. I don't know what the space will do when Trump turns his back on them, which it seems like he's going or wanting to do. But I do know that there are a lot of people that this was kind of a political awakening for them. Because they were kind of resting easy with Obama in the White House.
Yeah.
You know, a couple things on the healthcare bill, because I do kind of want to move on to what's happening on the activist side and all that. But there are just a couple more comments I want to make on healthcare. Right now, the bill as proposed that passed the House says that states can opt out of a bunch of the provisions of the Affordable Care Act, of Obamacare. And the interesting thing to me is that the bill they presented was states can opt out. I find that very interesting. I mean, first of all, it's extremely dangerous because opting out of the fact that insurance companies need to cover pre-existing conditions, one, it's draconian and an awful way to treat another human being, to say, we're not going to treat you because this is something that you were born with, or this is something that you happen to have when you were on a different insurance, but now you're on this insurance, and now you don't get coverage for it, or whatever. It's just a terrible thing to do to a person. But even more so, as we move forward technologically, the idea of not covering pre-existing conditions is going to become, I think, untenable, because with like gene analysis and hereditary stuff, like we're going to know so much that what counts as a pre-existing condition is just going to grow and grow and grow.
And have you seen the list of things that are attached to this? Like, if you're basically a woman, you're a pre-existing condition because birth control, giving birth, C-section, rape.
Yeah.
I was reading a depressing thread on Twitter where a lady was saying, you know what? I would not have reported my sexual assault if I knew that this was going to impact my healthcare. I just simply would have never reported it. And to live in a world where that's a thing that somebody said, that is just depressing as fuck and terrifying.
That aspect of this bill makes me think that Republicans are like, well, we can just say and do anything and women will still vote for us if they're on the right. Like, because it kind of, I mean, with Trump being such a misogynist and all of that, it was part of what I thought might help him lose was that a lot of right-leaning women would vote against him. But it kind of turned out that they identified more with being maybe white and maybe middle and lower class and maybe right-wing than with being a woman. But like that, it's so kind of disgusting. And it's like, wow, why do you must think there's no accountability at all towards women. Like, that aspect of it just baffles me.
So the other thing about this, though, is that what struck me as very interesting is that it's not that they're going to get rid of any of those. They're just going to make it possible for states to choose to get rid of them. So hopefully not very many states do if the thing even passes. And probably a lot of the blue states won't and the red states will or whatever. But I found that interesting because in my experience, when somebody's argument is, let's let the states decide, usually that is a retreat argument that you take once you've lost the national argument. Like, okay, if you don't think you can win your stance at the national level, that's when you retreat to, let's let the states decide, because you realize, oh, I'm not going to win this one, but maybe I can win in a couple of places that are on my side.
And then you cherry pick the ones that the data looks good for to say how you're successful, and then try and push it again at the national level.
Yeah, if you can even get it at that point. But you know what? I think the optimistic part of me, and it's dangerous to be optimistic after this whole election because I think that's gotten so many of us into trouble, like we're talking about with the French election or Brexit earlier. But the optimistic part of me says, man, it's really hard to go backwards from you have to cover pre-existing conditions. Like,
that's what I thought too. I mean, like, they're trying kind of still, but yeah.
Yeah.
So, just because it'd be so unpopular. But if he does stop caring, and if there is no accountability to not following up on his populist rhetoric.
Okay. And I mean, I think we should also point out that this bill that passed the House has only 17% of the U.S. population is in favor of it. Whereas single-payer healthcare, 58% of the population is in favor of that.
That's the other thing I wanted to bring up specifically about this bill. So I was reading a critique explanation about this from somebody on the right, so I assumed that it had some validity to it because they were very glowing about certain aspects of it, and they were critical about certain aspects of it. Specifically, so it would reduce premiums for a lot of people very quickly, but part of the reason it would is because it's going to make a high-risk pool. It's going to take everybody who actually needs the insurance, and it's going to put them in a separate pool funded by the government, which means funded by taxpayer money. So one of the real insidious things about this, and I think really points to people thinking many steps down the road of how healthcare and insurance works, is that in this setup, insurance companies are going to make more money because they have less sick people to pay out to, and they're going to make better profits. It's going to lower premiums, sure. But we're still paying for the sick people. It's your tax dollars. That's how insurance works. Like, an insurance pool is healthy people paying for sick people. How you set that up that's how you can determine things. But it's always going to be that with insurance or the single payer system. But with insurance, there's also middlemen in there making a profit. And I think, like, that was just one of the striking things to me with that bill. It's like, oh, so it's kind of double dipping. It's kind of like the insurance companies get happy, and maybe for certain people, premiums will drop, but you're still paying. It just looks like you're not. And maybe you're paying more. I have no idea how they're going
to
set it up.
And this, I think, is to make it seem even more insidious. I think one of the things that, if you're on the right, you like to do is to make assistance programs only for a small set of people. Right? Like, if everyone's paying into insurance, everyone pays premiums, and then everyone gets healthcare, yeah, the people who are not using very much healthcare, the healthy people, are subsidizing those who are using a lot. That's how insurance works. But if you're all in the same pool, then that's... It's sort of like Social Security, right? Everyone gets Social Security, so it's not something that gets attacked, right? People, like, very right-wing people will defend Social Security viciously, but they'll hate any program that benefits only poor people and not them. So I think what the right has figured out is, oh, you know what? If we get only the healthy people have this one program, but then the unhealthy people, anyone who actually needs a lot of healthcare, we put them in this high-risk pool, and then we tax everyone to pay for that high-risk pool, then they can demonize that later on down the line.
Mm-hmm.
They can say, why are we all paying for this, you know, thing that doesn't benefit most of us, only benefits this small group?
Triple dipping now.
Yeah.
I think. Insurance companies are happy. People still have to pay for it with taxes, so they really aren't saving a bunch of money. And now they get to demonize the group that needs it the most, that is most vulnerable.
And
interesting.
Should also point out that this bill is so bad that they voted to remove it because otherwise they weren't going to get enough votes. But they had a provision to exempt Congress and all their staff from
yeah.
the bill. They couldn't push it through with that still in there, but that just shows how bad it is that they didn't want it for themselves. That, like, that's never a good sign.
And that's like a sign that they feel like there's some still accountability. Like, it would be so hypocritical. But where is that? Where is that line? Where's the rest of it? I'm so befuddled.
It probably is like the 5 votes that they won by, they needed to remove that to get just those.
Yeah.
There's 5 people.
But there's still Republicans out there who do, I don't know. Yeah.
A few of them have elections coming up. It's basically
that's
what
true.
It is.
There's a great site that we should put on like the subreddit or something, talking about all the special elections this year and the candidates helping people mobilize in those states.
You know what? Let's pause for a moment right now, and then we'll get back and we'll talk about activism and some stuff like that, because I feel like we're shifting.
Yeah.
This is a natural break.
Okay. Yeah. There are also about 8 other topics I think we could talk about, too.
All right.
I know. This is sort of just a general chat sesh.
Yeah.
Marxism Today, chat sesh number 1.
Marxism Today is created by Red Wagner and Tony Schmidt, and is a project of the Democratic Socialists of America, Madison, Wisconsin chapter. We are not official spokespeople of the DSA, and the views expressed in this podcast are our own. You can find us on Twitter at RedWagner2, that's the number 2, and SchmidtAJ, that's SchmidtAJ. Our episodes are all available for download on our blog, marxismtodaypodcast.wordpress.com. You can share your thoughts about this episode and others on our subreddit, reddit.com/r/marxismtoday. Also, you can find information about the Democratic Socialists of America Madison chapter on our Facebook page, facebook.com/DSA Madison. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.